Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States and Mrs. Laura Bush.
Thank you all. Thanks for coming. Please be seated. Welcome to the White House. Laura and I are so honored you are here. I welcome members of my cabinet, members of the United States Senate, folks who work in the White House, the governor of Virginia, and Ann Holton. Thank you all for coming. Really happy you're here. We're here tonight to commemorate the 265th birthday of Thomas Jefferson, here in a room where he once walked and in a home where he once lived. In this house, President Jefferson spread the word that liberty was the right of every individual. In this house, Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark off on the mission that helped make America a continental nation. And in this house, Jefferson was known to receive guests in his bathrobe and slippers. Laura said no. I don't have a bathrobe. With a single sentence, Thomas Jefferson changed the history of the world. After countless centuries when the powerful and the privileged governed as they pleased, Jefferson proclaimed as a self-evident truth that liberty was a right given to all people by an Almighty. Here in America, that truth was not fully realized in Jefferson's own lifetime. As he observed the condition of slaves in America, Jefferson said, quote, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever." Less than 40 years after his death, justice was awakened in America and a new era of freedom dawned. Today, on the banks of the Tidal Basin, a statue of Thomas Jefferson stands in a rotunda that is a memorial to both the man and the ideas that built this nation. There, on any day of the week, you'll find men and women of all creeds, colors, races, and religions. You will find scholars, school children, and visitors from every part of our country. And you will find each of them looking upward in quiet reflection on the liturgy of freedom, the words of Thomas Jefferson inscribed on the memorial's walls. The power of Jefferson's words do not stop at water's edge. They beckon the friends of liberty on even the most distant shores. They're a source of inspiration for people in young democracies like Afghanistan and Lebanon and Iraq. And they are a source of hope for people in nations like Belarus and Burma, Cuba, Venezuela, Iran, Syria, North Korea, and Zimbabwe, where the struggle for freedom continues. Thomas Jefferson left us on July 4, 1826, 50 years to the day after our Declaration of Independence was adopted. In one of the great harmonies of history, his friend and rival John Adams died on the very same day. Adams's last words were, "Thomas Jefferson survives." And he still does today, and he will live on forever, because the desire to live in freedom is the eternal hope of mankind. And now it's my pleasure to welcome Wilfred McClay to the stage.
Thank you, President and Mrs. Bush, for allowing me to participate in this wonderful occasion, celebration of Thomas Jefferson's life. Usually when a revered figure turns a year older, we feel a little older too, and the world feels a little colder, a little more fragile. But it's a little different when a man turns 265. Remembering Thomas Jefferson makes us feel young, and not just by comparison. It's because Thomas Jefferson embodies so much of the promise of American life. It's because there is so much about him that is still vibrantly alive. And living not only in America, Thomas Jefferson deserves to be remembered and revered as a man of worldwide influence, whose name is known and loved and invoked by men and women from Beijing and Lhasa and Kiev and Prague. His belief in the dignity and unrealized potential in the minds and hearts of ordinary people is at the core of what's greatest in the American experiment. It is in this sense that James Parton, his early biographer, was right in making the following proclamation. If Jefferson is wrong, America is wrong. If America is right, Jefferson was right. But the cause of Jefferson is always more than just the cause of America. It's the cause of all humankind. Of course, we all know Jefferson's words, or some of them, but we want to know more than that. We want to feel that we know the man himself. But that is exceptionally hard with Jefferson. He eludes our grasp. He may well have been the shyest man, notwithstanding his bathrobe, ever to occupy the office of the presidency. Awkward and taciturn, except in small convivial settings, such as dinner parties, where he felt at ease and shed his reserve. In other words, he was not what people these days call a political animal. He loathed public speaking, giving only two major addresses while president, and none on the campaign trail. Of course, they didn't campaign for office in those days the way we do now. If they had, he wouldn't have run. He often felt that the work of politics ran against his nature and complained that the presidency was an office of, quote, splendid misery, which brought him nothing but increasing drudgery and daily loss of friends. Twice he withdrew entirely from public life, first in the 1780s after a disappointing term as governor of Virginia, then the second time at the conclusion of his presidency, when he left Washington disgusted and exhausted, anxious to be rid of the place. As he wrote a friend at the time, "Never did a prisoner released from his chains feel such relief as I shall on shaking off the shackles of power." Never was he happier than when ensconced in his Monticello retreat, his portico facing the wilderness, the place that he loved, the place where he found renewal. His example reminds us of how many of life's common comforts our leaders have to sacrifice in serving us. I contend that Jefferson's best known by his letters, best understood by his letters. He wrote almost 20,000 of them in his lifetime, and in them he seems to have felt freest and most fully himself. Although he complained to John Adams that he suffered, quote, under the persecution of letters, clearly the opposite was true. He loved writing letters, and he needed the buffer of letters interposed between himself and the world. But with that buffer in place, he was at his ease, poised and open and elegantly expressive. He used his correspondence to clarify his emotions and organize his thinking. And it's there that we see his full humanity most fully on display. But I may be in danger here of overstressing Jefferson's reticence and his reclusiveness, and that would be a grave error. The man was too many faceted for that. Here's how James Parton described the Jefferson of 1775, just 1 year before he wrote the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson, he said, was a gentleman of 32, who could calculate an eclipse, survey an estate, tie an artery, plan an edifice, try a cause, break a horse, dance a minuet, and play the violin. And at this point in his life, he was just getting warmed up. In other words, Jefferson was a virtuoso and a prodigy, a jack of many trades and someone who mastered most of them. Consider his political accomplishments alone. 4 decades of public service, ranging from his entry into the Virginia House of Burgesses to his retirement from public life in 1809 after 2 terms as the 3rd president of the United States. Or his keen interest in natural science, evidenced by 18 years as president of the American Philosophical Society, an office he held all through his 2 terms as president. Or his love of architecture, as embodied in the graceful neoclassical Monticello, which he designed and built for himself near his Virginia birthplace, or the serenely beautiful central grounds of the University of Virginia at Charlottesville. not to mention his overwhelming passion for gadgetry, which impresses visitors to Monticello. They always remember the revolving bookstand, the dumbwaiter, the copying machine, the automatic double doors, the great clock, the triple sash window, and countless other gizmos that the ever-inventive Jefferson either designed or adapted. If Jefferson was part Aristotle, he was also part Rube Goldberg. You all probably know that Jefferson, that inveterate designer, even designed his own tombstone and specified the three things that that was to say about his life. That he wrote the Declaration of Independence, Virginia's Statute of Religious Freedom, and was father of the University of Virginia. What did these three things have in common? Well, they go to the very heart of what Jefferson was about. They reflect his belief in the intrinsic dignity of the human person and the unlimited capacity of the free human mind. Coercion, whether of the mind or of the conscience, was the enemy of truth and true religion. Only the free mind, he believed, can freely discover the truth and freely choose to embrace it. Some will object that all of this praise for Jefferson fails to acknowledge the serious flaws in him. And that's true enough. I did not want to begin, as is overwhelmingly the fashion among my historian friends today, by emphasizing Jefferson's contradictions and shortcomings. But there are negative aspects to Jefferson's life and career that simply cannot be denied. No one can deny that although Jefferson opposed slavery in theory, he consistently failed to oppose it in practice, most notably in the conduct of his own life at Monticello. No one can deny that Jefferson's racial views, particularly as expressed in his book, Notes on the State of Virginia, are appalling by today's standards. These are not small flaws, nor are they the only ones. We are not wrong to insist on their being remembered, even today. Still, I think it's clear that the compulsion to criticize Jefferson has gone too far. Our era is possessed by a small-minded rage against the very idea that imperfect men can still be heroes. But we badly need such heroes. In fact, we can't live without them. Perhaps in the past we've been too prone to place our forebears on a pedestal. But it's far worse to feel compelled always to cut the storied past down to the size of the tabloid present. Perhaps the time for that has come to change. Perhaps we're wise enough now to know that imperfect heroes are the only kind there ever are or can be. So let it be for his ideas that we honor Jefferson above all else, and for the cause of human freedom and human dignity that he so eloquently championed. His failings may weigh against the man, but not against the cause for which he labored so heroically. That should be a lesson to us. Like Jefferson, we are carriers of purposes far larger than we know, purposes whose full realization cannot be achieved in our lifetime or even fully be understood by us, but which we are called to carry forward as faithfully as we can, as charges to keep. But unlike Jefferson, we have the benefit of his words to inspire us and his shoulders to stand on. Consider these words of the civil rights leader, Representative John Lewis. "We knew about Jefferson's faults," Lewis said, "but we didn't put the emphasis there. We put the emphasis on what he wrote in the Declaration. His words were so powerful. His words became the blueprint, the guideline for us to follow. From those words," Lewis said, "you have the fountain." It is the same fountain that today, 265 years after Jefferson's birth, still nourishes our lives and shows no sign of running dry. Today is a good day to drink from it anew and to say we are all Jeffersonians, because in one way or another, we all are. And now it's my very great pleasure to introduce Professor Richard Guy Wilson. I should say Mr. Wilson, in the tradition of the University of Virginia. Forgive me. He is the Commonwealth Chair of History of Architecture at the University of Virginia. Mr. Welch.
Mr. President, Mrs. Bush, and ladies and gentlemen, thank you. It is an honor to speak on Thomas Jefferson, who created several of America's greatest architectural icons. Thomas Jefferson, as President Bush remarked, knew this house very well. Indeed, he was the first full-term occupant of it. John Adams resided here for only about 4 months. The best description of this house from his time would be chaos. Much remained unfinished. Many rooms, such as this room. This was a large, bare brick cavern. The grand staircase was absent, and the wood floors were rough. Visitors recalled that Jefferson kept several tables of tools about. One, described as a long table, apparently sat somewhere down at that end of the room. It contained hammers, chisels, pliers, and also rakes, shovels, and hoes. And guests remember him taking the tools to fix locks, pound nails in walls, fix the window moldings, and going outdoors to work in the garden. Jefferson had proposed, back in 1791-92, his own designs for the Executive Mansion, or the President's House, as this was known then, along with the scheme for the United States Capitol. For the Capitol, he projected a great domed structure, but President Washington rejected his designs and competitions for the buildings were held. Jefferson, you may remember, served as the Secretary of State in the first Washington administration, and that office, Secretary of State, was a bit different than today, since it included internal administration as well as foreign affairs, and as such, he supervised the competitions and the groundbreakings for the new, or what became the White House and the Capitol. Jefferson, it also should be noted, offered his own plan for laying out Washington, D.C. Now remember, this is a new city created in the 1790s. And Jefferson's scheme, not to mention his loan of maps of great European cities, is fundamental to the plan of Washington as it was executed, along with the Great Mall. Of course, Major Pierre Charles L'Enfant is the person who gets the credit for this, but behind him stood Jefferson. Now, to return here to this building, the White House, as it officially was named back in 1901, Jefferson, while president, designed a number of additions, including some wings, the gardens, and then he commissioned his close friend, Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who he also appointed in 1803 to be the architect of the United States Capitol. He commissioned Latrobe to design both the north and south porticos. Latrobe's porticos, with their giant classical columns, I might say are the most distinguishing external aspects of the building. Now, I should note that it took many years to get the porticos built. Things were not that different than now, as far as getting government projects underway, funded, and then completed. I have outlined Thomas Jefferson's involvement in this building to try and make a point. The buildings he lived in, their style, appearance, furnishings, rugs, drapes, chairs, and gardens were a passion, or perhaps we might say an obsession. As he once said, and I quote, "Architecture is my delight, and putting up and pulling down one of my favorite amusements." Monticello, the domed house on a hilltop near Charlottesville, is an example of his interest, since there was originally another house up there that he had designed and built, but he tore it down to put up the one with the dome that we all know today, and that used to occupy the back of the Nickel. I understand that it's going to come back someday to the Nickel. Jefferson also designed his retreat at Poplar Forest, and indeed, wherever he lived, he remodeled them. The governor's palace in Williamsburg, his quarters in Philadelphia during the 1770s, a house in New York in the 1790s, or in Paris from 1784 to 1789 when he was the American ambassador to the court of Louis XVI. In all of these and more, he altered, changed to make them serve his purposes and taste. Monticello, as I've indicated, was in a constant state of construction. And if any of you have ever lived through a house remodeling, you might remember how conducive it is to family harmony. Well, Jefferson lived in a construction zone his entire life. What were Jefferson's architectural achievements? He wrote to his close friend, James Madison, who was later an occupant of this building, and I quote, "But how is a taste in the beautiful art to be formed in our countrymen unless we avail ourselves on every occasion when public buildings are to be erected of presenting to them models for their study and imitation? You see, I am an enthusiast in the subject of the arts, but it is an enthusiasm of which I am not ashamed, as its object is to improve the taste of my countrymen, to increase their reputation, to reconcile them to the rest of the world, and to procure them its praise." Now, this letter to Madison in 1785 was an occasion of his design of the Virginia State Capitol in Richmond. And I would argue that the Virginia Capitol, or the State House, is his most important building. Say important building, keep that in mind. A large Roman temple that stands in Shockoe Hill in Richmond, originally overlooking the James River. The Virginia Capitol is among the first major public buildings constructed after the Revolution, and its classical ancestry helped to determine the look of American governmental architecture for the next several centuries. Instead of red brick and skimpy details, Jefferson gave us an image that drew upon the great traditions, forms, and symbols of the past, but transformed into a new language of classicism for a popular democracy. Thomas Jefferson is sometimes labeled a gentleman or an amateur architect, but this is a misnomer. Yes, he was self-trained, but there were no architecture schools. They were not invented in this country until the 1860s. Rather, he learned from books, and he had the largest architectural library in the young republic. And he did the drawings, he figured the specifications, he figured the dimensions, he figured out how many bricks were needed, how much timber, how much glass to order, and he superintended the construction. Jefferson both learned from and he taught those who worked for him, black and white, free and enslaved. Jefferson designed houses, both his own and those for friends, utilitarian buildings such as shops, farm structures, three courthouses, a jail, and he frequently offered his wisdom to his colleagues. He was always Mr. Suggestion Box. But this, and this makes him an amateur, he was never paid for any of it. He did it all gratis. Although the Virginia State Capitol is his most important building because of its legacy, his greatest is, of course, the academical village of the University of Virginia. It is totally his creation. Yes, he did ask for suggestions, and he took advice, as any wise person does. But the university is his concept of what is the appropriate setting for education. Jefferson felt that one learned as much from your environment as from the professor gabbing away in the classroom. The university is a great lawn, enclosed on three sides and open at one end. Pavilions for the professors and dormitory rooms for the students on the two long sides are tied together by colonnades of classical columns in various orders and sizes in a grand dramatic gesture. It is a place for meetings and interaction. Dominating the composition at one end is the Rotunda, a great domed building that housed the library. The Rotunda, based on the Pantheon in Rome and considered one of the great and most perfect monuments of antiquity, Jefferson has taken an ancient symbol, the dome of the cosmos for the Romans, the dome of the heavens to Christianity, unity in our capital, and transformed it once again. It becomes the dome of enlightenment, of reason. It is the library, the mind of the university. In his hands, the library became the central element, the symbol of the modern university. Jefferson's architectural achievements are considerable. He contributed greatly to Washington, D.C., and he created three of our great architectural icons, the Virginia State Capitol, Monticello, and the University of Virginia. Architects are frequently known for their considerable egos. Frank Lloyd Wright was sometimes classed as one of the greatest American architects, and he had a very large ego. He could never say anything good about anybody, but he once said, and I quote, "If Thomas Jefferson were alive, he would be at the head of the table." But Jefferson saw his accomplishments in a very particular way, and he both designed the obelisk-shaped tombstone at Monticello, and he ordered it to contain a very particular statement. He was Mr. Control to the end. It contains nothing about the public offices. What it does say, and I quote, "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia," end quote. Two political statements which are fundamental to our freedoms, and the institution, and do I dare say, the architecture by which they would be carried out. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. McClay and Mr. Wilson. Thank you so for your reflections on Thomas Jefferson's life and his contributions to our nation. And thanks to each of you for joining us today so we can learn more about the legacy of one of America's most influential founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson believed that education is the cornerstone of a free society. So it's therefore little surprise that he viewed the founding of the University of Virginia as one of his top achievements, as we know from both of your talks. He called the building of this school the last service he could render his country, saying, and I quote, "Could I see it open, I would not ask an hour more of life." But in fact, Thomas Jefferson lived a little over a year after the University of Virginia opened its doors. During this time, he was involved in the university activities, and he invited students, including a young Edgar Allan Poe, to dine with him each Sunday at nearby Monticello. Today, Jefferson still shapes the lives of the students at the school he founded. The architecture of his academical village encourages free study in a collaborative environment, and UVA's philosophy of student self-governance epitomizes our third president's democratic ideals. The 18 men I now introduce are heirs to this tradition. The Virginia Gentlemen are UVA's oldest a cappella vocal ensemble. They perform for distinguished audiences across the country and around the world. Tonight is their first performance at the White House, and we're happy to have them. Here to perform a few musical selections, including the University of Virginia's school song, please welcome the Virginia Gentlemen.
Ocean and door, I long to see you. We're bound away across the wide Missouri. I long to see your smiling valley and hear your rolling river. Smiling valley, we're bound away across the wide Missouri. 'Tis 7 long years since last I seen and door.
Fly me to the moon and let me dance among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. Worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. Heart with song, now let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, in other words, in other words, I love.
Thank you so much. On behalf of the Virginia gentleman, I'd like to thank Mrs. Bush for the kind introduction, and thank you, Mr. President, for the honor to join you this evening in celebration of Mr. Jefferson. The grounds at the University of Virginia are indeed alive still today with the teachings of our founder. He's taught us that honor is the first chapter in the Book of Wisdom, and we would like to close this evening with a very special song, our school song, our alma mater, the good old song. And in doing so, we pay tribute to Mr. Jefferson's legacy that he has left not only at the University of Virginia, but also in this great country. Thank you.
For dear old UV.